Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm a huge fan of making the player go through like a massive gauntlet to get a reward.
Hell yeah.
And then someone will come back and be like, we shouldn't be mean to the players. And I'm like, what? Just because that's how I love to play.
I think this would make the players sad. Welcome to Pocket Buds, a back pocket podcast where I talk to my best buds about video games and stuff. This week, we're talking about GDC. The Game Developers Conference that we know today, a huge meeting of the minds in game development, was not always the huge affair that it is now. There once was a time where it was called the Computer Game Developers Conference, and it was a 20-something person event in some guy's house. That some guy was Chris Crawford, known for his work on Eastern Front on the Atari, and also for quitting the games industry in 2018 because everyone's dumb and he's smart. That's the vibe I got from his goodbye blog post, at least. But we jumped too far ahead. The first GDC in 1988 happened in Crawford's San Jose home, and the next one happened at a Holiday Inn. Every year, the event had to move to a bigger and better venue because more and more game developers were heading down or up or over to California to learn about their craft and network to their heart's content. It wasn't until 2005 that GDC found its forever home in San Francisco's Moscone Center, or at least that's how I think it's pronounced. It's stayed there ever since, and it was in 1999 that they took the computer out of the name, which makes sense because video games weren't just on the computer anymore. They were also on other things, like a console or a watch from McDonald's. Unlike many video game events that you might have gone to over time, the Game Developers Conference is not open to the public. It's not a PAX situation, or even what E3 later became. Perhaps it's how GDC has managed to outlive E3, being an industry event at all. But perhaps it's not the exclusivity that keeps it alive, but instead its purpose in the game dev world. So what's GDC for? What does one do at GDC or get out of GDC? I personally have never had the pleasure of attending GDC, although it is something that I'd love to do at some point. While I could be boring and rattle off the events and highlights of each year, I thought it would make more sense to instead talk to somebody that did go this year and got a hell of a lot out of it. So joining me today to talk about just what the average game developer gets out of GDC is dramaturge and writer for Massive Monster and my friend, Jojo Zhu. Jojo, how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling great. I'm in Sydney and it's kind of a dreary day. Winter's coming.
True.
But, you know, booked, blessed, busy.
Oh, love that.
Yeah, a bit of a break in the old work day to come chat with you, which I'm very excited about. Love doing it.
It's not as dreary as it was yesterday, I feel. And it's always funny to talk about the weather on a podcast episode because, like, this comes out, like, what, like a week later? And
I know.
Are like, it's sunny today, actually, which I respect. I respect someone listening to a podcast and thinking that it's live.
Yeah, absolutely. And for any of you, you know, like script screenwriters, just think, you know, lights up, 10th of April, 2024, interior, the home office, outside, it's grey, it's drizzly. And let that
and
set the scene
for you.
It's
a little bit cold. It's a little bit cold. I'm excited for the cold. So you, speaking of writers, you originally got your start writing for the theater. How did you find yourself in the games industry?
It was kind of serendipitous. It was like, I don't want to say fate, but my whole life I've loved playing games, as many of us who work in the games industry do.
Yeah.
So I had always loved that, always thought it was kind of like a hobby. I feel like with games, right, if you don't work in the industry or know somebody who works in the industry, there's this like big canyon between the layperson and the people who make games. And you think to yourself, games writing's not a real job. That's not something someone actually gets paid to do, right?
Yeah.
So I always loved theater. I was one of those kids who did like drama in high school. I did the maximum amount of English I could do. And I left school, studied a theater in my undergrad, went on to do a Master of Fine Arts in Writing from the National Institute of Dramatic Arts here in Sydney, Australia.
NIDA. Very nice.
Old NIDA. Anyway, freelanced for ages, just doing anything that would pay me to write. I did a bit of screen, audio drama, live performance, performance art. And then Julian, who is one of the directors at Massive Monster on Cult of the Lamb, we knew each other from mutual friends. He'd come seen some of my work. And so one day I just get a Facebook message to Tim going, hey, we need some writing for this game. Would you mind coming on board just as a contractor? And I was like, no worries, man. That sounds like such a fun little gig. Twist me arm. I'll write on your game. And so I started on really simple things like item descriptions. We all love an item description.
Classic.
Little lore lines. Moved on to some, you know, NPC dialogue kind of stuff. And then over time, I'm still with Massive Monster now. My role has grown and I do pretty much all of the writing for it in collaboration with one of the directors. And here I am, having a grand old
and
time.
Here. Oh, having a ball. Yeah. Well, I mean, like for me, I feel like a big part of what makes Cult of the Lamb's writing so juicy is its goofy NPCs and side characters. Is it Plimbo?
Yeah, old Plimbo.
I'm a Plimbo head.
Yeah.
I'm rocking with Plimbo. Plimbo's rocking with me. Who's been your favorite kind of character to write for slash around?
Oh my gosh, there's actually so many. The most exciting thing, we say all the time that there's a real duality of tones in Cult of the Lamb. So on one side you have like the occult and the archaic and the grandiose kind of language. And on the other side you have like a Plimbo or like your followers who are goofy little guys who love to talk about poop.
Yeah.
So the fact that I get to do both is really exciting. I would say an early fave for me was Harrow, who is like an owl bird guy. He's a lore NPC. He's there to just like drop juicy tidbits about the world. And he speaks in archaic English, which was so much fun to kind of learn and understand the structure of archaic English to do that. Anytime I get to write like a little riddle or a little rhyme or a poem, super fun. Some of the characters will just burst out into rhymes just because I want them to.
You're like, I feel like rhyming today. Twiddly dee, twiddly dum, pee pee, poo poo, bum bum.
Perfect. Yeah. Get that in the game. Yeah. That's gold right
there. Yeah, get that in the freaking game. What can I say? I've been a writer in my time. How does writing for video games kind of differ from writing for stage? I mean, it's like other than the big obvious, or say the big obvious ones.
There was honestly more in common than I kind of anticipated, because it's all storytelling, right? Like at the end of the day, you're telling a story to somebody who hopefully wants to hear it. So there were things like dialogue I found really easily transferable. When you write for performance, like dialogue is your whole kit and caboodle, like that's your lifeblood right there. So character dialogue was kind of really easy, as well as being really economic with it. Like lines can't be too long, players lose interest, or you just run out of space in the text box and you just have to cut it down. And so I feel like the economy of language was kind of the same there. But then the difference is very much like, and I've only worked on indie projects, so that's like my context here, is that everything just happens all at once. So you're like writing this game and you're kind of like also coming up with like the story beats and you're also just filling in all the descriptions, the character text, that kind of stuff. And at the same time, the game has been made, the mechanics have been developed, like the game loop is getting confirmed and things will just change at the drop of a hat. And so it's a huge lesson in flexibility.
Yeah.
And also, as the big obvious, player agency, huge thing, writing for a game. You have to account for the fact that you're telling the player's story, really, or just facilitating them, as opposed to if you're writing like play, where you're like, I'm telling you a story.
Absolutely. Have you had any moments while writing for Cult of the Lamb where you've just kind of like taken a step back and be like, that was a learning experience? Which is basically just the nice way of saying that fucking sucked.
Yeah, all the time. still to this day, I've been doing this for 2 years now, and there'll always be something that, you know, like one of my colleagues or whatever comes through and is like, that's not gonna work. A lot of it's like you start with blue sky thinking and you're like, oh, and then this could happen and this is the reward and they have to go through this. I'm a huge fan of making the player go through like a massive gauntlet to get a reward.
Hell yeah.
And then someone will come back and be like, we shouldn't be mean to the players. And I'm like, what? Just because that's how I love to play.
I think this would make the player sad. We might not do this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a time and place for it. Absolutely. I remember when Cult of the Lamb had just come out, because I've been on that train early, right? And I remember when it had just come out and people were like, it's too easy. And, oh, this is a dungeon crawler for babies. And I was like, okay, we'll turn up the difficulty and I assure you it will not be that easy. But also, like, I feel like with gamers, the second they're given a challenge when they're not expecting it, instead of being like, oh, how exciting, they're like, I'm going to be mad now.
Oh, my God, totally.
I don't really get it.
I feel the same. Like, cults for me, the thing that maybe I love about it most is that it is really accessible. Like,
absolutely.
In terms of there's like heaps of accessibility settings. But when you're tackling it, like if you are kind of like new to gaming or a first time gamer or a, God forbid, a casual gamer.
Oh, yuck.
Cult is actually really easy to pick up. And that's something I really love about it. Especially because, and I don't like, please, if you disagree with this, let me know. I would love to have some discourse. But, you know, like colony sims are how a lot of people get into gaming. Like, you know, yeah. The Sims, Animal Crossing, Stardew Valley, all that kind of stuff.
But also Age of Empires, you know,
Age of Empires
was a first game for so many people.
Yeah. And so many people find gaming through playing those games. And so to have something that meshes that with like a dungeon crawler or a roguelite,
yeah,
which can for some people be pretty challenging or scary to pick up. I just thought it was great that it could meet players where they are. And it meant totally. That so many people could hop on board and enjoy the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever had any ideas for Cult of the Lamb that got canned that you'd like to share with the class?
Oh my gosh, what was there? Well, I don't know how much I can share because, and this might just be,
oh, yeah, truth.
This might just be my bosses being really nice to me, because what they'll do, right, if something doesn't make it in, they'll go, oh, we'll put it in a future update.
They're like, maybe later.
Yeah. And so maybe it's just fully canned or maybe it'll come back, you know, hold on to hope.
I think that's a beautiful way to think about, you know, like eventually. Maybe someday.
Maybe someday.
you shake the magic eight ball.
Yeah.
Will this idea of mine be in the game? Maybe someday.
And if it doesn't ever make it in, you can read about it in 20 years in my memoir.
Oh, my God, yes. So do you have any plans to continue theatre work alongside writing for games, or are you on a straight path right into the heart of video game writing?
That's always the question. I do still work in theatre. I do a thing called dramaturgy, mostly. I do still write plays.
I saw that in your description. and please continue answering the question, but I'd also love you to explain what dramaturgy is for someone dumb like me.
Dramaturgy is something that, like, unless you usually work in theatre or screen or performance art, you don't really encounter a lot because it's a very behind-the-scenes kind of job. And they're like, you could kind of call the equivalent for Froze to be like an editor, or the equivalent for games to be a narrative consultant. But
right.
A dramaturg is somebody who comes in and they will work on something with you to kind of define the mechanics of meaning making, which is just like a bunch of fancy words to be like, they'll they'll help you out.
Yeah. So you're still doing that.
So I still do that. I work with a lot of cool new Australian work. Just like these awesome, exciting writers who, you know, just are making really cool plays, and I get brought on board to help them deliver their vision and kind of iron things out and things like that. And I'm hoping to continue doing that. I don't know, man, time is like so finite on this earth, and there are so many things I want to do all the time. And I've yet to, like, you know how, I don't know if you watch 30 Rock and Liz Lemon's like, can I have it all? I can have it all.
I can have it all. Yeah, I...
time is finite. No, I'm constantly thinking about that because I, you know, I wouldn't say I'm on the level of working directly in the games industry, but I do work in a somewhat creative field. And I think it's this weird thing of like, I want to pursue all of my creative passions at once. That is a bad idea because then you'll burn out and suddenly hate doing everything that you love. And that's a really sad way to look at it. But at the same time, it's the sort of thing where you feel like if you can't do it right now, then you'll never be able to do it, which is so not true.
So not true. But I feel like
it's literally so not true.
We get really hung up on that idea of, one, I think we love a prodigy. We love a young prodigy, like a savant. We get so obsessed with the idea of being a kid wonder.
Yeah.
And so when you're young and you work in the creative fields, you're just like, I've got to get my magnum opus out there. Like, yeah. Once you're over 30, you have nothing interesting to say.
I've never been afraid of 30.
No.
I've never been afraid. I know so many people, mainly men, which I find very interesting, that are afraid of hitting 30. And I don't get it because who gives a shit?
Truly. You know why? It's because guys never had their Sex in the City.
True. True. I feel like men don't have those. They've got like role models in you know, their 40s and 50s.
Mm.
But like your 30-somethings, there's not really any role models for men there. So they kind of just see 30 as this nothing age. So it's terrifying. It's just like growing up. But we have Sex in the City.
Thank God. That's a
thank God.
That's a market that we could tap. Representation, yeah, for men in their 30s.
Oh my God. Why isn't anybody going for this?
We got to step up. You know, it's a story that only we can tell.
We've just thought of a really, really good idea. Shit.
And so we're here to announce our next game.
Yeah.
You play as a man in his 30s, navigating big in his 30s.
Okay, hold on. Okay, but I think there could be something really interesting about a game being written by women, which is about a man in his 30s navigating being in his 30s. I think there's an idea there.
Yeah.
I think that could be.
I'll get the pitch deck together. Let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. But anywho, so the topic for today, now that we've gotten acquainted, we know what you do. We know how you have worked in the industry. We're going into our topic, which you are quite well versed in, having pretty much just come back from it. But the topic for today is GDC, the Game Developers Conference. And you were able to make your way there thanks to a grant, I'm pretty sure. Would you be able to kind of explain that process for us?
I would absolutely love to, because anything I can do to shout out Screen Australia and the fantastic work they do is always worthwhile.
Hell yeah.
So yes, I just came back from GDC, plus a few extra weeks in America for fun, because, you know, I already flew all the way over there. I could just come straight back. It's a really long flight. Yes, I was lucky enough to attend through the support of Screen Australia and their Future Leaders Delegation, which is a program that it was the inaugural year this year, and it was me and four other fantastic emerging game devs who had never been to GDC before. That was one of the requirements. Who had shipped at least two games, another one of the requirements, and were able to articulate what GDC could do for them, their practice and their career. Mm. And so I found out about this at South by Southwest Sydney. I ran into Amelia, who works at Screen Australia as a game financer. And yep. We just had a chat. She was like, oh, I was here talking about the programs, and I had missed their actual presentation on this. And I was just trying to get some free cheese from one of the tables. We just started a small conversation. And so I was just
I was on a cheese quest. Yeah.
I was there for the cheese. And yeah, she was like, oh, you know, we've been here just chatting up some of Screen Australia's new programs. And I was like, oh, what are they? As if she hadn't just spent 60 minutes talking about it. But she very kindly told me about the different funds they had. And the one that I cottoned onto was the Future Leaders Delegation, which was the opportunity I just explained. So yeah. I was like, oh, slay, I'll go look that up. Went and looked that up. And I thought it was an opportunity that if you are in that position of never having been to GDC, shipped two games, you should absolutely go for it. Because it was a grant that covered the costs of going there. So that's like flight, accommodation, per diems, your travel insurance, all that kind of stuff. And also put you together with four other people in a cohort. And we had the support of two Screen Australia staff while we were there, Lee and Amelia. And they kind of just guided us through our first GDC, which if you've been before, is a very overwhelming experience.
And actually, that kind of leads to my next question. What is GDC like? How does it compare to more front-facing consumer events like PAX, and how does it stand on its own?
It's a very overwhelming experience.
Yeah.
It is, unlike a front-facing event like PAX, this is for game developers, people who work in the games industry from all over the world. I think there was like 30,000 people just descending on the Moscone Center in San Francisco this year. Which is crazy because it's like a huge conference center, and also like everything around it, the restaurants, the hotels, are just booked and chockers full of game developers.
Awesome.
And the thing that appealed to me hugely was I had a two-pronged approach going to GDC. One was that I love to learn, which is super nerdy, but they have like different kind of tracks, your narrative track, your level design track, like composition or any of that stuff. So I was there for narrative.
Yeah.
And they have just this like huge host of talks by people who currently work in the industry, people who are of varying levels from incredibly like established and accomplished to people who work more emerging or on the indie scene. And you just get so many niche gems. Like I went to a really great one about writing a story treatment for games specifically, about branching within scope. I went to one on Twitch integration.
Sorry.
That's right. I was like,
terrible. Sorry.
I went on one about tit integration, huge emerging market. Sex sells.
We're so back.
But you get to like learn just so much from so many different sources, which is just an opportunity you don't get, I think, very often.
And I think that probably the closest thing we have to compare to that here in Australia is GCAP. Mm. Have you been to GCAP?
I have. I went to my first GCAP last year.
Oh my God, me too.
Oh my God.
How did you find it? And how do you think it kind of compares to GDC as well?
I really liked it. It is kind of a smaller, more local GDC.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's still the same structure of like talks, breakouts, like the meet to match thing going on. But GDC is just GCAP on steroids, really. It's just so huge. And in America, which is like a crazy place to be.
America is a crazy place to be, absolutely. Was that your first time that you'd been in America as well?
Yes, it was my first time. And it was just an honor to be a part of the American cinematic universe, you know?
Oh my God, absolutely. I feel like when I was in America, each day I felt like, damn, my life like a movie right now.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you spent a little bit of time there afterwards. I mean, obviously that's your personal life, that's your life. But did you find anything that kind of invigorated you to kind of come back with some new ideas for, I mean, the future of your gaming career? That is a huge question.
Big cues, big cues. But yeah, absolutely. So I went to New York. It was very Sex in the City.
You were having your Carrie moment.
I was having my Carrie moment. Taking the subway, walking along the street, went to the Met. You get it.
Wow.
But New York is a place that really, really values the arts. Like, obviously, they've got famous galleries. They have Broadway and off-Broadway, everything like that. And so when you work in a creative field, or when, like, generating creative content is your job, I think sometimes you just need to go away and be saturated in other people's creativity to reinvigorate your own. And so I saw so many plays, went to so many galleries and museums, and I came back here being like, damn, I want to make art for the rest of my life. And games is art, obviously.
Games is art. We've had this conversation on the show before, and I think we came to the conclusion that games is art. It's very true.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
True. So I've also been told by a friend of the show and also to all, Chloe Appleby. I love that woman. I hope she's listening. I love that woman so deeply. She said from her perspective, you're probably one of the folks to kind of get the most out of GDC. So what do you feel like you got out of the conference that you think was the most valuable to take back with you?
Definitely. And I think a lot of people would say this, it's the connections you make. It's the friendships you make along the way.
Oh, that's so nice.
But I feel, especially in this age of remote work, right, where it's really easy to feel kind of isolated. And if you're maybe like me and you didn't kind of come up in this industry, you did a lateral move over from a different one, you kind of feel like you don't really know who's who and what's what. And so being able to be in the same physical location, especially after the year that the games industry has just had and continues to have. To just like be in person, like talking to somebody who does the same thing you do or does something radically different or has the same obstacles and overcame them and can give you wisdom, or has the same obstacles and hasn't overcome them, but you get to like kind of have a little bitch about it together. It's just so rewarding. And then, of course, you swap business cards and you stay in touch. And those relationships can become great collaborations in the future. Also, I was at a narrative roundtable, right? Which is like, you just sit at a giant table with heaps of people who do the same job you do in varying capacities. And you talk about what matters in the industry, which was incredibly satisfying, really gratifying. Mm. And then the person next to me was just like, oh, hey, my name's Jade. Yeah, I write for Neopets. And I was like, oh, I love your work. Huge fan of your work.
I just want my soul jumped out of my throat.
I was like, I love the giant omelette. The Neopets Bazaar. Oh my God. I love it all.
I love the cheese rolling down the hill. I love what you do. I would cry.
It's just one of those things where GDC is that kind of place where you will just be like rocking around like some random, start a conversation because everybody wants to chat while they're there, right?
Yeah.
All the game devs let out of their caves, looking at the sun, meeting each other. And you just talk to someone and you find out that they have worked on something that you've admired or played or really liked for a long time. Apparently, I heard the guy who made Tetris was there. I didn't meet him.
Yes, but holy heard crap. About this.
I was like, you're a legend, dude.
Well, I mean, do you have any good stories, any interesting people that you met there?
I almost met Pendleton Ward, who's the creator of Adventure Time. That is honestly my biggest regret from the trip. He was hanging out in the park and my friend messaged me and they were like, Pendleton Ward of Adventure Time is here. And he was just at my hotel and I was like, keep him there, I'm coming.
Hold him there.
Do not let this man leave. But he had gone by the time I got there. So, you know, it's not all wins. Sometimes there are losses.
Well, yeah, I mean that's definitely a huge loss. But did you have any wins? Come on. You got to have something to nourish your soul.
It was there, like, had a really, really good conversation with the creators of Oxenfree, which was so cool. They did a really good talk on how you navigate making a sequel. And I was like, you guys really know what you're talking about. Mm. The fact that these people can take the act of creativity and break it down into a process, a rubric, whatever you want to call it, like really reveal the science behind it, I found super fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Screen Australia pairs you with a mentor to help you navigate through it. And my mentor is David Gator, who is a co-founder of Summerfall Studios, Stray Gods.
Yeah.
Recently BAFTA Games nominated with a host of other awards.
And he's an incredible writer as well.
Dragon Age, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, my days.
I know. And I got to meet him before I even went over and I was like, hi.
And how do you think that mentorship helped you as well?
Oh my gosh, hugely. I think like the value of a mentor, right? Like mentors are so useful and everybody should have one.
Yeah.
To have somebody who was so had been in the biz for such a long time was really, really helped me navigate some trapfalls, especially in terms of kind of IP that gets big. Obviously, Cult is like got quite big. David Gator's worked on some really big ones. And so we got to be able to talk about that, about how you navigate when IP franchises and you know, you are suddenly working with other writers, or you have really strong fan response and they have, want particular things from the game. What do you do about that? And it was just hugely beneficial. And he's such a sweet person as well.
I might have met him during Games Week. And I was like, hello. And then I ran away. I mean, Games Week really is the closest thing we've got to something like that. You don't really see as many people flying over for Games Week as you would for GDC.
No,
do you think there's space for it to grow?
I think so. I mean, I think... like Australia, right, is really revealing itself as kind of a powerhouse in the indie game scene. We've had some really big ones come out. We continue to have some really, really good games being made all the time.
Yeah.
And by so many, you know, devs who just live locally here, down under.
Down under.
Down under. Yeah. I think it would be really cool, and based on what, you know, Screen Australia and other kind of state-based screen agencies are doing, they're putting a lot of money behind the industry. So, you know, maybe we're the next San Francisco.
Totally. Well, I mean, do you think there's anything that maybe GCAP or just Games Week as a whole could kind of learn from GDC? Like, was there anything that you got to experience over there that you think maybe should be brought over to Australia to kind of, I guess, boost us as, like, I don't know, a hub for games in some kind of way?
I think something that GDC does really well. So there are a lot of people who go to GDC and they do not attend the conference because there are so many offshoot things happening at the same time. People take advantage of the fact that everyone's going to be in the same city. And so you have, like, just other events or parties or gatherings, networking things, social things that just crop up. And also the pitching aspect as well. And that just kind of flourishes around the actual conference. I feel like maybe there would be space for that to happen around Games Week, around GCAP here, where there could be a bit more support or push behind having things that are games related but not necessarily part of, like, the GCAP track kind of thing.
Yeah. I think like, it's starting to happen a bit more, definitely. I mean – You would, Massive Monster goes absolutely crazy around Games Week, especially last year. There were so many events coming out of the Massive Monster space.
Yeah.
Which was great because I absolutely agree with you. I think just having one event be the event is not the way to go. You know, there should be way more stuff happening around it, which is, you know, obviously why they call it Melbourne International Games Week and not just GCAP and then PAX. You know, like it's good to have stuff happening around it.
It is. Totally. Also, like, frankly, it's really expensive to go to GCAP. Like, it costs money. Same with GDC. Yeah. The pass is just so expensive.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. I wish it wasn't that way. It would be a lot more accessible if it wasn't.
Well, that's kind of another thing that I was going to ask as well. Like, obviously, we're talking about how cool GDC is and how much it rocks and how it's great for getting, like, experience and stuff. And, you know, GCAP's great too. But what would you say are maybe some of the pitfalls when it comes to kind of conferences like this?
Definitely the cost, since we're already talking about it, is the first one that comes to mind. And particularly looking at GDC. Even with the grant, the all-access pass was out of my reach, considering the costs of everything else. The all-access pass is like, oh, my God, between $1,500 and $2,000 US dollars. It's so expensive. I know.
Oh, my days.
And then San Francisco itself is a really expensive city. It costs a lot. The accommodation is so much. The thing that shocked me was literally the price of food there is so much more than I could have anticipated. Like, if you want to go out to, like, I don't know, a decent-ish restaurant, which you honestly, you do that a lot when you're there because you meet people, you want to get to know them, or you see people you haven't seen in a really long time and you want to go grab a meal. Like, it's 40 Australian dollars to have a meal there. Just things like that just really put it out of reach, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then, like, frankly, this is not something I struggled with, fortunately, because I was gifted with the stamina of an ox. Thank you, God, and all my parents. It's an exhausting week. Everything is just shoved into, like, that 5-6 day period.
Yeah.
And there's huge overlap. Like, sometimes you rush from A to B, or there's, like, a million things you want to be at once. And it can be very taxing on your mental health, emotional health, physical health, to just kind of keep going and going and going. Not to mention you've got, like, a 16-hour flight on either side of it too.
Yeah, God. I mean, I feel like accessibility is, it's a pitfall for so many gaming events, I feel. they all cost money. Sans a few, but most of the time they cost a lot of money. Do you think there's the expectation that people are just going to have their work pay for it, so it doesn't really matter?
I think that that is an expectation that's put in place from my limited experience going. But a lot of people I talk to were like, work paid for me to come over, kind of thing, which is, you know, great if you have a job that wants you to go there, can afford to send you there. I was surprised there was a really large student presence actually at GDC, and they were kind of like domestic students, as in from inside the USA.
Right.
I was also like, how'd you afford to get in here? That's crazy, dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I feel like the US uni system is strange as well, because you're already paying, you know, a metric ton to be there. So potentially they're getting sponsored as well. Maybe.
If anyone knows the answer, tell
us. Yeah, please let us know. If you are listening and you happen to be from America and you also went to university in America, let us know. How that shit work?
What's going on? I don't know.
Was there any kind of culture shock for you there as well? Are American game developers much different to Australian game developers?
Okay, so... Before we went over, right, Screen Australia hosted this two-day workshop for us where they got heaps of people who'd come to GDC before to come in and talk to us and be like, this is how you should prepare yourself. This is how you don't get stabbed in San Francisco. And we were like, oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for this knowledge. but I remember so clearly, I think it was Trent from League of Geeks telling us, I think it was him, but he was just like, look, Americans are incredibly confident and they believe in themselves so much. And Australians, we like a larrikin and we have big tall poppy syndrome. We don't like to be, we feel arrogant when we're backing ourselves. So if you're going to go to GDC, if you're going to meet people, pitch, talk to them, network, you need to just step up and believe in yourself. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm sure you're exaggerating. Surely people is people no matter what.
Yeah.
But then you get to GDC and you talk to Americans and they are just so confident, so full of strong belief in themselves. Which is not a judgment call, right? It's neither good nor bad. Yeah. It is what it is. But it was something that I was like, oh my God.
Would you say that confidence was contagious?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. And I don't know if it's so much contagious, like, you know, you believe in yourself, so I should believe in myself. Or if it's more contagious in the, you know, you're sinking or you're swimming, buddy.
Woof.
But either way, something happened and it worked. After the first, I think, day and a half, like the first day, honestly, I got back to the hotel and I was kicking myself. I was like, you didn't speak enough. You didn't introduce yourself enough. You didn't want to talk to strangers enough. Like you're not taking advantage of being here. But then, you know, after being there for a couple of days and you kind of get used to it and then you warm up to it and things get easier.
Mm. Yeah, totally. And Americans, from my experience at least, love when Australians are like try and match their confidence as well.
Because
Americans love to talk.
They'll
see you in the street and if you give off even the slightest vibe that you're not from around there, they're immediately like, hey.
I know.
How long you been here?
Do you know what Americans love at the moment?
Yeah.
So it used to be like saying good day, right? Or shrimp on the barbie.
Yeah.
Now they love, if they find out you're Australian, they want you to go, oh no.
Oh no. Oh no.
Cleo,
no.
The condensation. Cleo.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that Americans have gotten into H2O just out water. Because I think that show genuinely was a masterpiece to me.
I agree. I loved that show. Where's its Emmy?
I agree. I feel like there's not enough appreciation for preteen shows for girls and actually just how well written they were and how interesting they were. Like, oh, three regular girls from the Gold Coast go into a cave on a very specific night and suddenly they're mermaids, but it's every time they touch water. Like,
that's it's original, you know?
It is original. It's well done. Well, I'm more surprised that there hasn't been like an H2O just sad water game.
Somebody write that down.
This is like a Roblox game.
Well, a H2O just sad water Roblox game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a Roblox game for everything.
Yeah.
But it seems like there wasn't a video game for H2O Just Add Water. And that hurts me, I think.
Well, at least we know what we're doing after we ship this middle-aged man game.
Yeah, the man. What should we call that one? Man in his 30s?
Yeah, man in his 30s.
Is that too simple?
I think it is. We need something hooky.
Yeah.
Mr. 30-something.
Mr. 30. I do like that. Mr. 30-something. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so Mr. 30-something and then H2O Just Add Water, the video game.
Yeah.
Which we may have to get licensed. And I actually don't know who owns the rights to H2O Just Add Water. So
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
We'll get a legal team.
Yeah. I mean, lawyers don't cost that much money, right?
No, I'm pretty sure that they're free.
Yeah. Well, isn't there like that one lawyer in the Australian games industry?
Oh, my God.
No, there's just that one guy.
I know. His name escapes me, but I immediately knew who you were talking about.
You know who I'm talking about. Yeah. Like the one guy who works with every single dev in the Australian games industry. And I'm pretty sure it's for like IP.
Yeah, cool. I'm pretty sure.
So like we could, if we go to him and be like, what do we have to do here?
If you are listening to this podcast, Mr. Lawyer Man.
Mr. Lawyer Man, whose name has escaped us, but we respect you and think
deeply,
you are.
Deeply respect you.
So fantastic. We want to make an H2O Just Add Water game. We're going to do that. But yeah, so do you think you'd go to GDC again?
Yeah, in a heartbeat.
What do you think you'd get out of it a second time?
I feel like my second time there would be pretty different to my first time there. I think your first time going, you're like a bit stars in your eyes, a bit overwhelmed,
yeah.
A bit like you want to try everything because you don't know what you like yet. And so now that I've got more of a feeling of what it is good for me anyway, which is attending the talks and maintaining relationships now that I've created them, would be, I think, quite different and equally as rewarding.
Yeah,
but also something absolutely. I've been meaning to say about when we're talking about accessibility for GDC.
Absolutely.
Sorry to bounce back.
No, please.
That I do want people to know going there is that it is an event that is very much built around the consumption of alcohol. And if you don't drink, I do feel like that could potentially be alienating. I do think we need more alcohol-free spaces for people to connect with each other and network. And also, if you do drink, American drinks are stronger than Australian ones. So keep that in mind.
That is crazy to me considering the drinking culture that we have in Australia.
They don't measure when they pour spirits, they free pour.
Oh, see, so I haven't drunk for 7 years, right? And you know, proudly, but also
get
because
it, girl.
I don't have a choice. So it's like,
get it, girl.
I feel like when it comes to drinking culture in Australia, maybe my view is a little different because I haven't done it for such a long time, but I feel like Australian drinking culture is so pervasive and it's in everything. It's in almost everything you do, almost everywhere you go as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And the games industry, I think, is a really interesting one because it's kind of similar here where like if you do have an event that isn't like a direct activity, it's usually drinks.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually like networking thing at a bar or a networking thing at a pub. And it's just like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? And like with America, I can't imagine what it'd be like there, you know?
And I think as well, because one, your days are super full. So it's not as easy to be like, let's grab a coffee, you know, kind of thing. Because everybody's got meetings or lectures or whatever that day. And it's also got that kind of summer camp feel to it because people come back year after year and maybe that's the only time that year that they see these particular friends. And so there's like a huge kind of celebratory feeling to it all, which, as you mentioned, does often go hand in hand with alcohol.
Yeah. So last but not least,
mm-hmm.
what would you say was/is your favorite thing that you experienced or saw or learnt or got from GDC?
Oh my gosh, that's a tough one because the list is luckily very long.
You can say them all if you want. Power to you.
One, it was because at Massive Monster, we all work remote. To see some of my colleagues and dear friends in person was really, really, really nice. And it was a work expense.
Love that.
The narrative roundtables, I went to two of them. And to be in that space with these people who love what they do, they care about it so deeply and were so willing to speak with me and share their knowledge and connect was fantastic. And also, again, Neopets Ryder was there.
Incredible.
And honestly, this is like barely GDC related, but on the last day, me and some friends, new ones and old ones, went bike riding around Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And it was just such a great time. Just, it's a beautiful park. The Golden Gate Bridge gorgeous. Right there. Like, God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like that's such a huge part of these things as well, is like when I went to Melbourne Games Week, sure, the experiences that I got going to GCAP, you know, doing interviews there, going to PAX, seeing stuff there, they were all fantastic. But it was also just like getting to spend time in Melbourne as well that I really enjoyed, and like walking around, going to record stores and vintage stores, and like getting to experience the city that comes with the event, I think, is such a huge part of it as well, right? Especially with new friends that you've just made.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was just, it's community, right? Like, as I mentioned before, and as we all know, it's kind of been a pretty rough time recently for the industry.
Totally.
In terms of like the layoffs, like everybody's having, I mean, AI is a huge conversation at the moment. And, you know, there's been a lot of kind of discourse and hate flying around over diversity in the industry, to like put it quite frankly. And so we did have a few chats before we went over about what the mood will be, like what should we expect. And it was just, everybody was really joyous and everyone was happy to be together and connect with each other. And I really valued that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, at least in my eyes, I think there's a big difference between, I guess, with the discourse. With the discourse around the industry right now, I think there's a big difference between how people outside of the industry see the industry and how people within the industry see each other. You know what I mean?
I totally agree. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so
I think it's very different.
It is very different. And so having GDC, which is for people who work in the industry, to be able to come together, and it felt like, oh, yeah, all right, maybe we are a united front. Like,
yeah,
we were all fighting the same battle.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so good. You know, that's exactly what you want, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Jojo, thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it. How can we find out more about your work?
So you can follow me on Twitter, JojoFinal_final. And honestly, for games, you can keep an eye on Cult of the Lamb and Massive Monster. Cult of the Lamb has an excellent Twitter page and TikTok and everything, run by the amazing Josie Fletcher. And we're going to have some pretty exciting stuff going up on there soon. So keep an eye out.
Wahoo.
Wahoo.
Once again, thank you so, so much for joining me today. Loved chatting with you.
Love chatting with you. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And a big thank you to you for listening. If you're liking what you're hearing and you'd like to hear more, consider supporting Backpocket over on Patreon. If you support us at the silver tier and above, you can get access to our bonus episodes. In this week's bonus episode, I'll be joined by friend of the show, Chloe Appleby, who also got a whole lot out of GDC, but in a very different way. Here's a sneak peek.
So we do a two-hour hike, which we went through every terrain possible in this very...
Mud?
No, actually, no, I'll take that back. Not mud.
Okay.
Not mud. Yeah. But
think boys speak. Think before you speak.
Think before I speak. Yeah.
You didn't even go through mud.
You know what? I'm an idiot.
Oh, God, that would have peaked. And hey, if you really like what you're hearing, why not give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using? Better yet, why not give us a nice little review? You can also find us on Twitch, where we've got our main live show every Thursday from 7 p.m, or on TikTok, where we're constantly posting very good stuff for you to cast your big, beautiful eyes on. And then there's the socials, a la Twitter and Threads and whatnot, which you're also welcome to get around. Once again, thanks so much for tuning in, and as Chris Crawford would actually say, bye!
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.